Today's program was brought to you by VisitNapaValley.com, the official page for travel to the Napa Valley, America's legendary wine, food, arts, and wellness capital. For more information, visit www.visitnapavalley.com.
I'm Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli. When I'm not hosting In the Drink, I'm also the beverage director of the Epicurean Group of Restaurants, Dell'Anima, Lartuzzi, Anfora, and La Picho. And if you like this program, you can always listen to it live at 10 a.m. on heritageradionetwork.org. And the program's also available via podcast on iTunes. So thanks so much for listening. I'm really excited today. We have the winemaker, owner, vineyard manager, East Coast sales representative of Belle Pont Winery, over in the Willamette Valley in Oregon on the show. His name is Brian O'Donnell. Welcome to In the Drink. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Joe. It's a pleasure to be here.
Really excited to have you on the show. I think this is the first time that we've had Oregon represented. But I want you to tell us a little bit about your history, how you got to Oregon. I believe you started in the East Coast and somehow made your way out west. And how did you find this little corner of the Willamette Valley and settle in that area?
Yeah, indeed. It was a bit of a circuitous route to the Willamette Valley. I was actually born here in Brooklyn, grew up in Queens, went to high school, Upper East Side of Manhattan, college in the Bronx. And then I drove through Staten Island on my way to California in 1977, lived in the San Francisco Bay Area, worked in Silicon Valley, and started making wine just as a hobby in my garage and basement in the mid-80s. And after a few years, the hobby got completely out of control, and my wife and I picked up our lives and moved up to the Willamette Valley in Oregon, traded our little bungalow in the city for 70 acres out in the country, kind of an Eddie Arnold Green Acres experience in the early days. But we established Belle Pont, bought the property in 1992, and planted the vineyard starting in 94. First wines in 1996.
Wow. And now winemaking has gone on in Oregon, the Willamette Valley, since the 19th century, but kind of think of the modern day of winemaking really is the past 30 or 40 years. That's sort of what I think of when I talk to my staff about the Irie vineyards being established. And so you're still somewhat in those earlier days when you're going out there, maybe only 15 years or so after. Am I thinking of it in the correct way? What's the history of Oregon to you?
Yeah, that's pretty close. We actually, just last month, we actually celebrated the 50th birthday of Willamette Valley Pinot Noir. 50 years since David Lett put the first Pinot vines in the ground. So this year is kind of a year of celebration, celebrating 50 years in the wine business for the Willamette Valley in Oregon. So it's a pretty exciting time. You know, we've reached certainly critical mass, and there's, you know, the original pioneers for the most part are still involved. There are some second generation folks taking over family domains, and tons of new interest from around the world. I think there's definitely recognition that this is a special place, if not the special place in the world for Pinot Noir.
And how have things changed from the time that you got there? What did you find when you were there, and how are things different now?
Well, certainly a lot more wineries, a lot more planted acres of vineyard. The area, our particular little corner of the Willamette Valley, which is the Emerald Carlton area, was kind of a little bit on the lunatic fringe of the Willamette Valley at the time. Most of the action was centered around Dundee Hills. And there were only a couple of wineries and a dozen or so vineyards in that neighborhood. But since then, the area has really grown up around us. And pretty much every nice south-facing hillside right now is planted to Pinot Noir and Chardonnay.
Yeah. And now your vineyards are also south-facing hillsides. Is that correct? And how important is that in the area? Is it possible to even ripen and make quality wines if you're more east or north-facing, or is it really all about south-facing?
Most of the vineyards are east, so east, southeast, southwest. There are a few people planning for sparkling on north-facing slopes, which is kind of an interesting idea. We're trying to achieve something a little bit different in terms of the ripeness and the maturity. But you know, pretty much everything is due south or southeast, southwest.
And
up on hillsides as well. There's very little planted on the valley floor.
And I know Yamel Carlton requires at least something like 200 meters of altitude, right? So they're pretty high vineyards in there.
Yeah, it's actually 200 feet.
200 feet, yes. I'm sorry. I was thinking in European because we have most of our wines. I mean, we love featuring your wines at Lipicho. You can generally find at least the Riesling and Pinot Noir. Lara Lohenhar and I are big fans of the wines. I should have said that at the top of the show. So they're vines, and it's an area that has some decent altitude. But what defines Yamel Carlton? What makes that a specific area within the Willamette Valley? Because give us a little bit of an idea. I've never personally been to the Willamette. I know it's a large area, over 100 miles across. But the Willamette in itself has, I think, a pretty strong presence and a feeling. Maybe people in New York might feel like we know what wines from there taste like, but it seems like In that big distance, there must be a ton of different terroirs and expositions. What makes Yamel Carlton unique, and what makes Willamette unique?
Yeah, as you said, Willamette Valley is a fairly large appellation. The I think it's 3.2 million acres.
Wow.
Which is I think the second largest after the Columbia Valley, which straddles Oregon and Washington. But it's 100 miles long from Portland to Eugene, and follows the track of the Willamette River. Most of the vineyards are planted up on benches and hillsides. There's very little planted in the valley floor. And there are really three, sort of two and a half major soil types that really define the different characteristics. The Dundee Hills area is all volcanic origin, relatively young, in geological terms, 12 million year old soils derived from basalt. And then the Yamel Carlton area is dominated by sedimentary soils. So it's sandstone, siltstone, typically 2 to 3 feet, some a little bit deeper. And the wines are quite different from those two major soil types.
Right. And just to clarify, sedimentary soils generally come from glacial movements. Is that correct?
Comes from it's basically stuff that settled out in the bottom of the ocean and then got uplifted with the movement of continental plates.
Okay. And so will you find fossils in your ocean fossils in your vineyards?
Yeah, we find little oyster shells and things like that from time to time. And there's some little veins of chalk that run through the formations as well.
So a hypothetical vine of the same age and same exposition, farm the same way, but in Dundee versus Yamel Carlton, how will the expression be different because of the soil?
Yeah, we have one vineyard in Dundee Hills that we've worked with since the 90s, Myrto Vineyard. So we have a pretty nice side-by-side comparison in our own cellar between the two. And I always find the volcanic soils from Dundee Hills to have a lot more red fruit character. So strawberry, cherry, raspberry flavors, aromas. There's a spicy overtones, Christmas spice, Asian spice, a little bit of white pepper, black pepper as well. And the wines generally have a little higher acidity. When you move over to the, and it's interesting because some of these vineyards are only a couple of miles apart, but geologically they're 30 million years apart.
If you didn't hit on the acidity, I was going to ask you about that because it's something I've heard from multiple growers who work with volcanic soils, that something in the volcanic soil fixes the acidity. Do you have any ideas to why that happens? Is that one of the beautiful mysteries of nature?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's actually a guy in Toronto who's an MS who's doing a book on volcanic soils, which should be coming out, I think, in about a year. So stay tuned. He's actually doing the research. He's going around the world from Willamette Valley to Mount Etna and other places, researching volcanic soils and what the similarities are and the underlying factors. So, but I do know that just experientially that the Yamel Carlton tends to have more structure, more tannin. The fruit profile lends itself more toward dark fruit, black raspberry, black cherry, cassis, a little more structure and more herbal floral characteristics mm-hmm. as well. So the wines are quite distinct, quite different. I think the almost in musical terms sometimes that the Dundee Hills has more treble and the Yamel Carlton wines have more bass.
I like that. And one of the things I've always appreciated about your wines, other than the fact that they just taste really, really good, is the way that you work with the environment, the way that you work with your land. You've been growing your grapes organically since the 90s. You don't fine or filter most of your wines. And something that I was actually in a way surprised to find that this isn't even an issue is that... you don't irrigate your vines. And I always pictured the Oregon, I mean, not most certainly the Pacific Northwest, but really Oregon as being a more humid, wetter area. You're by a river. The thought that people would need to irrigate to me was kind of surprising. I know that certainly in Washington, if you're on the kind of desert side, it can be very, very dry in the summer. But you guys don't irrigate. And apparently that's not the norm in the area.
Yeah, up until about 25 years ago, all the vineyards in Oregon were dry farmed. You know, irrigation came in as a tool fairly recently. It is certainly a little bit controversial from a wine quality standpoint as well as a natural resource utilization standpoint. There's a little group called the DRC. The Deep Roots Coalition.
Not the Domaine de la Romanée Conti? No.
Is that DRC also?
It's the secondary, famous one.
It actually was taken from the Democratic Republic of Congo. But obviously there's a play on words.
Deep Roots Coalition.
A Deep Roots Coalition,
and
yeah.
The idea being that if you irrigate, your roots won't be as deep.
Correct.
And what is the importance? I mean, what is the importance of deep roots? Is it the strength of the vines? Is it the complexity? Why are deep roots so important to you?
All the above. You know, it's the deep rooted vines tend to be more naturally drought resistant. The theory certainly is that when the roots dig deep into the mother rock, that they're past the topsoil, they're into the mother rock, and that's when you really get the expressions of sight. You're mining basically the subsoil and the site, which creates more complex, more interesting, and more typical wines.
And so, what would be the typical vineyard depth of let's say a 10 or 15 year old vine that has been irrigated versus the root depth of non irrigated? How much? Is it very drastic?
Yeah, the thing that you're going to find, and again, I haven't dug holes in people's irrigated vineyards, so I can't speak from experience. Certainly the irrigation, the watering encourages more roots, more shallow roots, versus a deeper root system. So in conjunction with the dry farming, one of the practices that we do every couple of years is we actually go and prune the roots. So we take a deep plow, about 3 feet deep, right next to the vines. To cut some of those shallower root system and encourage more growth down low.
More growth down low. Yeah. Very interesting. Now, I've actually seen pictures of experiments of vineyards that were treated with fertilizers, with chemical fertilizers versus not. And the vineyards that have been treated with chemical fertilizers, the roots stay much closer to the top as well. And that's because, obviously, the vine roots need not only water, but nutrients. So I imagine that if you want the deepest possible roots, if this is something that's very important to you, you don't irrigate and also absolutely no chemical fertilizers.
Because very often chemical fertilizers get applied through an irrigation system. It's one of the fairly common called fertigation techniques. But certainly, yeah, the two go hand in hand, and the practices that most of the deep roots folks employ are organic farming practices, making compost and green manure for providing fertility in the vineyard, replenishing the little amount of nitrogen we're taking out, and building up the organic matter in the soil. So these are all really important things.
That's right, because you can't really do a crop rotation with grapevines.
Yeah, it's a problem, because vineyards, by definition, like orchards, are a monoculture. So the only thing you can really do is you can work the fringes, work the environment, work what's around the property. For example, on our site, we have 70 acres, but only 18 of that is planted to vineyard. The rest of it is in pasture. It's a native oak savanna. And maintaining these kind of natural buffer zones is a way of creating some diversity in the environment. And the other thing we can do is what we do in between the rows. And we do a kind of a sophisticated 9-year rotation, crop rotation in the rows between the vines, where we're using grasses, native grasses, and then some legumes like crimson clover and oats to provide some biomass to put more organic matter back in the soil.
This is a fascinating conversation. I want to continue it, but we're going to have to take just a quick break. And we'll be right back with more Belle Pont Vineyards.
And the break song today is called Pale Blue by The Landing. Today's program was brought to you by VisitNapaValley.com. Welcome to the Napa Valley, North America's legendary wine and food capital, where the art of living well is defined, and each season holds a story waiting to be discovered. Life feels slower here, lived at a place where tables are set with care. Fine wine and food are created from the bounty of our own vineyards and gardens, and relationships with friends and family gathered around the table are somehow sweeter. When planning a trip to the Napa Valley, we invite you to visit the destination's official visitor website, visitnapavalley.com, or stop by Napa County's official visitor information center, located in downtown Napa, where our friendly and knowledgeable community ambassadors can assist you in creating your own legendary Napa Valley experiences. The Visitor Information Center is located at 600 Main Street in Napa and is open from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., 7 days a week, 360 days a year. Your invitation to experience the Napa Valley beckons. Take a deep breath, lose yourself in our quiet green and golden hills, renew your body and spirit, taste our legendary wines and cuisine, and experience the people who make this valley like no other in the world. For more information, go to visitnapavalley.com.
All right, we're back on In the Drink with Brian O'Donnell from Belle Pont Vineyards in a different valley, in the Willamette Valley in Oregon, making some absolutely beautiful organic and now biodynamic wines that you can find on our wine list over at Le Picho. Ms. Lara Lowenhar and I are big fans of the wine. So welcome back to the show. Before we left, we were talking about biodiversity in the vineyard, and I would love to focus a little more on this idea of you having 70 acres of land, but only devoting 18 of those acres to actual vineyard sites. It says to me that you have certainly a lot more potential to you can grow it if you want to, but it sounds like it's an intentional decision to leave some of it either as trees or as some other type of farmland. What sort of relationship does the rest of your land have on the vines? And is there kind of a perfect balance? Would you recommend this kind of 18 acres to set, to 42, or that, my math's probably terrible. Is there like a 1/3 to 2/3 kind of balance, or how does it all kind of work together? And how do you picture this?
Yeah, so that's a good question. Every site is different, and there's no perfect balance. There's no perfect ratio, but clearly having a 15-acre property with 14.5 planted to grapevines and having neighbors next to you doing the exact same thing. I mean, there's certainly places in the old world that do that and do it very successfully, but they certainly struggle with the impacts of the monoculture. On our property, we have it was certainly a few steep ravines and hillsides, native oaks around. We places that we couldn't really plant if we wanted to, and for people who haven't been in the Willamette Valley, it's a very, very different than the wine growing regions, because pretty much all the vineyards are up on the hillsides. There's virtually nothing on the valley floor. The valley floor is planted to wheat, to hazelnuts, seed crops, grass seed, clover. So we kind of have a diverse agricultural base sort of built in with the into the valley to begin with. And then in our place, the system that we've developed over the years is integrating livestock into the mm-hmm. operation. This is kind of a pre-industrial farm, if you will, where we're raising market lambs as well. We've got some a few beef cattle, chickens, geese, and everything is kind of works together in supporting the vineyard. So, for example, during the winter, we put the sheep in the vineyard. For a couple of months before the vines start growing. They eat the grass, fertilize as they go, and that basically saves us one trip through the vineyard with the tractor to mow the grass. So we're cutting down mm-hmm. on fossil fuel use and pollution and so on and so forth. And the right now, if you look at our vineyard, it looks like a golf course on the inside, because the sheep have got stuff mowed down perfectly. You can take your putter out there if you wanted to and start and practice.
And I've heard it. I don't know if the sheep hoof is the same as maybe a horse. They weigh less, but I've heard that there is a natural soil aeration that happens from a hoof going through it, as opposed to compacting it from the tractor. Do you find that to be the case?
Yeah, that certainly makes sense. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
That's super interesting. And I also read that you have some bees on the property. Super interested in this. There's been some local beekeeping here in New York City. I've been a real big fan of, there's a show on CNN, Morgan Spurlock, Inside Man. And I don't know if you're familiar with it. I just watched, he did a whole thing about industrial, commercial, and local beekeeping and what's going on with that. Now, the grapevines are self-pollinating, right? So do the bees even pay attention to the grapevines? Or are they just...
Yeah, they don't. We have a lot of other flowering plants mm-hmm. around the property. We have a small orchard that goes back. The property we're on was one of the original wagon train destinations. It's been a farm since the 1840s, late 1840s.
Wait a second. Wagon train is in Oregon Trail?
Oregon Trail.
Wow.
Yeah. Actually, the Amhill Carlton area is the north of the Amhill Valley. And that was the final destination for a lot of the early Oregon Trail pioneers. They went overland to Oregon City, and then they hopped on a steamship, basically a paddle wheel steamer up to Lafayette, and then fanned out into the valley where we are now.
So there was this 19th century allure of this very fertile, beautiful valley that would be a great place to live and settle down. And then it happened again at the end of the 20th century.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's a pretty for those who haven't visited the Willamette Valley is a pretty special place.
What's it like for a visitor? What would be your tips for someone who wanted to come visit? How far would you fly into Portland, and then how do you get up there? What's the method to do this?
Yeah, the best thing to do is to Portland's the main airport. Spend a day or two in Portland on the front end or the tail end. There's a terrific food and wine scene in Portland. A lot of transplanted New Yorkers out there. You hear a lot of New York accents when you're hanging out in Portland. And then the wine country is about basically an hour drive from there. And so you spend a couple nights in Portland. You come out to Willamette Valley. There is everything from the Allison Inn and Spa, which is a super kind of high-end experience to, you know, really cool, funky B&Bs and pretty much everything in between.
Great. And has the Portland food scene really, have you found that that's kind of gone hand-in-hand with the wineries? Do you guys communicate a lot? I know that the restaurants in Portland keep getting better and have more notoriety. Have you seen any effect?
Yeah, there's definitely a symbiotic relationship between the between Wine Country and Portland. The for us, we're a small winery. We do our own deliveries. I actually deliver wine to restaurants every week in town, straight from my cellar to their wine coolers.
You personally deliver?
I personally deliver it, and very often I do it on my bicycle as well.
Now, how many? Do you have like a little trailer behind you?
Yeah, a little trailer. I can one on the radio, so I can't show you a picture. But if you go to our Facebook page, it's a picture of the little wine delivery setup.
That blows my mind. So do most wineries have like a tasting room and normal tasting room hours, what you might find in Napa Valley, for instance?
Yeah, certainly. And now there are more and more. When we first got started, there weren't as many. There's a little group called, I think it's called Oregon 365, that have tasting rooms open every day of the year. We're open by appointment, and we do a couple of events a year.
So I'd recommend for our listeners that the most interesting thing about any winery isn't the tasting room and it's not the winery itself, but the vineyards, because many wineries look very similar. Tasting room, you can taste the wines in your Portland restaurant or in New York, but vineyards, I think, are truly unique and no two are the same. How would our guests get good vineyard tours, like rather than just going and showing up and paying to taste through a couple of wines, which is fun. I love tasting through wines, but I feel like you get a really full experience by getting out into the vineyards and seeing them.
Yeah, and that's where people like some of the smaller wineries that don't have tasting rooms come into play. You have to do a little bit of homework. You have to figure out where you want to go. You got to call up or email, make appointments ahead of time. But typically, when people show up at my place for an appointment, I just look at the shoes they're wearing. If they're wearing high heels, we're probably not going to go out in the vineyard. But I'll always offer that as the first thing, the place to start, and go out in the vineyard and talk about what we're doing there, and then come on in, come down to the winery, sit down at a picnic table if the day is nice, and taste through a few things.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice that you don't hear too often. If you're going to visit a winery, don't wear heels. Wear shoes that you don't mind if they get a little muddy. Because if it's rained in the past couple of days, that it might be muddy out there, but get out and see. I think seeing the vineyard sites is what is truly special and unique. So I'm curious. I've read about a wine that I guess you've had for a while, but maybe we might see a bottle in New York, the Gamay grape. I'm most familiar, obviously, as I said before, with the Riesling and Pinot Noirs, which I absolutely love. I know you make Chardonnay and Pinot Gris, but I've heard you have some planting of Gamay, which is really interesting to me.
Well, to back up, Willamette Valley is probably, Gamay Noir is probably the number two red variety in the Willamette Valley. Which is a little misleading because Pinot Noir is like 99.5%, but of that half percent, Gamay is probably the next next most widely planted. It does pretty well there. It is. We had it on our property since 1994, our original planting, and I really wanted it to taste like Cru Beaujolais, but it doesn't. So for years I've blended it into a little Pasta Grande Rosé that we called Cuvée Contraire. But recently, and starting in 2009, I kind of gave up wanting it to taste like Cru Beaujolais and realized that maybe it's like something from Val d'Aosta or some other Gamay region. And the wines are kind of cool. They're fun. They're spicy. They have a little bit of tannin without a whole lot of structure behind them. So it's kind of a fun diversion, if you will.
So you started bottling it just as 100% Gamay?
100% Gamay, yeah. And
is this available in New York or just through your mailing?
Yeah, it's not. It's pretty much just at the winery.
Just at the winery.
Yeah, and a couple of places in Portland that twist my arm to give them a few bottles.
Oh, we might be trying to twist your arm to send some over here. Well, you won't actually, have to bring it over on a bicycle, though.
Okay. Yeah, that'd be a long trip. The we actually planned a little bit more again, made this last year. So instead of having enough for 40 cases a year, by next year we should have enough for about 100 cases.
Yeah.
So I'll keep you on the list.
Please let us know. Lara and I are big Gamay fans, and to have a delicious one from Oregon sounds really exciting. Now, what do you think is the future of the Yamhill-Carlton area? What do you think is going to do well there in the next few years?
Well, you mentioned Gamay. I think the up and coming varietal for the Willamette Valley in general, Yamhill-Carlton in particular, is Chardonnay. The quality of Chardonnay has coming from Willamette Valley has increased dramatically in the last 10 years, with access to better clonal selections from Burgundy, and just the focus of the winemakers. 10 years ago, if I went to talk to one of my neighbors, or even 5 years ago, talk to one of my neighboring wineries, mm-hmm. we'd spend all our time talking about Pinot Noir. Today, we'll spend half our time talking about Chardonnay. So there's a lot more brain power
really
going into it.
Because I find that, obviously, Willamette known for the Pinot Noir, Pinot Blanc a little bit, right? Pinot Gris and Chardonnay. It seems like, I guess it makes sense as the counterpart to Pinot Noir. But I know that you're also a big fan of more aromatic grapes like Riesling and Alsatian varietals in the area. It's unique and interesting that both of those can grow side by side.
Yeah, it's true. The Willamette Valley's got tremendous potential for any cool climate white variety. They used 30 years ago, there's some killer Chenin Blanc coming out.
Wow.
That was a dead ringer for a great Sauvignon, but nobody could sell it, so we gave up. The viticultural potential is there for almost anything, any cool climate white variety. It's really more of becomes more of a marketing issue, and how many different things do you want to talk about, and how many things do you want to be really good at. But clearly the community is focused now on Chardonnay. There's also a little skunk works on Riesling,
mm-hmm.
Trying to up the profile of on the technical side as well as on the market side. But Chardonnay is the thing that that's going to be where the energy gets devoted on the white wine side for the next, 50 years.
And here's one more tip for when you go and visit a winery or meet a winemaker whose wines you're really a fan of. Always ask if they have any recommendations for other wines that they really like, because chances are if you like their wines and they like the other ones, you're going to like the other ones as well. So who's making interesting Chardonnay, or who are some other growers that you kind of really enjoy what they're doing?
Oh, so now I'm going to get in trouble because of course I'm going to forget somebody who I should be mentioning. But we just had a Chardonnay symposium in Oregon last weekend. It was a fifth annual, so I got to taste about 50 of my neighbors' wines. Certainly the Eveningland, Bergstrom, Brickhouse, a bunch of newcomers, Metello, Goodfellow Family Wines, Lundin. There are just a ton of really, really good Chardonnays
out of
Oregon now.
We'll be on the lookout for it. Thank you so much, Ryan. It's been such a pleasure to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
And you guys should definitely look out for Belpont Wines. They are some of the most soulful, beautiful, and really, truly delicious wines that I've had out of Oregon. So look out for them, and you'll see them on our list at La Picho. I also would love to thank Gene Heyer from Artisan Wines, who's helped to organize the show today, and our producers, Jory Morales and Jack Inslee. Thank you guys for always making sure this goes well. And thanks to all of you for listening. This has been In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.